beneath hair that has been parted and combed. He stares at Annie's blotchy face and says, I just keep thinking, Doc wouldn't want me to be an ass to you at his... He can't say funeral. Annie presses her palms under her eyes. Save it for afterward, she suggests, her voice full of water. Cor lets out a laugh like a sob. The funerals for the fallen guardians are held on the Island of the Dead, the burial site of the Dragonborn before the Revolution. It's approached by a narrow footpath from the outer palace that winds to the far side of Pytho's keep and connects, by a single footbridge, to the island in the centre of the River Fir. I realise, setting foot on it today, that I've never attended a funeral before. What I remember of the island has changed. The sepulchres that contained the remains of my ancestors were defaced in the Revolution, and no graves were added for the Dragonborn killed during it. I wonder, looking around the island, where they would have lain. My parents, my brother and sisters. There is no easy history of what happened to those killed on Palace Day, but I know enough to know they were not honoured in death. Today, at least, a blanket of snow masks the old destruction. We've made the walk on foot, the dragons processing above us, from the palace to the island with the senior ministry officials and family members in attendance. When my boots crunch the unmarked snow of this ancestral island for the first time, I'm braced to feel the pain of Leo, Leon's son. But when I see my friends gathered around the pyre, all other thoughts fade. Palor, landing at my side, presses a nose against my hand, and his folding wings quiver. The procession gathers. The biers are mounted. Riders with their dragons form a ring around the pyre. The widowed dragons have landed beside them. Their wings droop, their tails brush the snow, and when they lift their heads, their restless eyes find the horizon. They won't remain much longer. Annie moves with leaden feet toward the Sutter family, gathered beside Cor. She bends into a bow and offers them Duck's folded uniform. When Mrs. Sutter reaches out to take it, Annie isn't able to let go. Duck's mother stoops to take Annie's hand and pull her upright. Annie, darling, come here. She folds her into an embrace. The rest of what she murmurs as she presses her forehead against Annie's, I cannot make out. Behind the pyres, a new plinth has been erected. On it, in Kalish, reads, The Fallen Guardians. Three names have been inscribed below. There is space for more. Before the pyre is lit, Atreus delivers the funeral oration.
8 years ago, 32 young people from all over Kallipolis stood before me and took vows that made history for our island. They vowed to ride for Kallipolis, to defend her, to guide her to justice. They vowed themselves to this service until death released them.
I remember that day. I remember saying those vows, wondering if I believed them, feeling the chill of the words and realizing I did, realizing that I wanted to be a guardian of Kallipolis. To follow this man and to believe in his vision.
We are all of us revolutionaries,
Atreus goes on,
dreaming of a juster world for our children, willing to sacrifice in the name of great ideals.
We are all of us revolutionaries. I suddenly feel that the words of Atreus Athanatos are more powerful than he is. Dragonfire that can't be contained. Because he is right, in more ways than he knows. I still believe those vows, even if I don't believe in the man. Now, watching the pyres for my friends, more than ever.
Today, We recognize the first of you to complete their vows. We recognize their sacrifice. And we look to you, the guardians who remain, to continue their work. Long live this revolution.
Too cold to spark, torches are held before the widowed dragon's maws, and they breathe them into life. The pyre's light and the dragon's launch into the growing dark, into the empty sky. They bear no harness, no saddle. They never will again. They turn their course due north. Watching them move as if drawn on an invisible line, I feel the hair rise on my neck. I've heard the thing described before, but seeing it is eerie. An exodus. Lotus, standing beside me, has one hand lifted to shield his eyes as he watches the horizon, the other holding Rock's shoulder as his face streams. "Why north?" Lotus murmurs. "North of the Medean Basin, the cold is too severe to be hospitable to dragons, much less the hot springs required for their hatchlings. New Pythos is already borderline." "No one knows. The dragonborn assumed they go north to die." Lotus looks startled, but before he can ask more, the singing begins. Deirdre has taken Atreus's place before the pyre. Her voice is high and clear as she begins the anthem of the revolution, the arrangement minor, and she starts with the alternate verse. "We bleed, we die for the glory of Kallipolis." She sings until the dragons have dwindled to nothing on the red horizon. Afterward, in the growing dark, Palor and I make our way through the seamless snow to the part of the island once dedicated to the graves of the Stormscourge family. Dracarches and lesser dragon lords were buried on our estates in the highlands, but those who served as Triarch were buried here. We wander through the sloping mounds until, at the base of the section, I find the youngest graves, the ones that belonged to my grandparents. I begin to wipe the snow away, steeling myself for what I'll find. Palor breathes on the last of the ice, and it melts to water. The graves are cracked, the sculpted images of their faces shattered. I know that beneath the ground their remains will be gone, exhumed and dissolved in quicklime, as all the empty graves of this island were when they were dug up during the revolution. It's family I renounced when I came back from that duel with Julia, and Atreus renamed me under oath.
"You are Lee of no father and no house."
But I will kneel at an ancestral gravesite and pay respect, even if I have forsaken living kin. Even if the dragon at my side is an Aurelian, not a storm scourge. It's grown so dark that I don't realize until I hear her that Annie has knelt beside us and is helping clear the snow. Aela nips at Palor, who launches at her. They begin to gambol among the snowy stones, leaving a melting trail behind them. "We could erect a memorial," Annie says. I look up at her. "To the fallen dragonborn. In the revolution. I know it wouldn't be the same, but..." Her cheeks are pink flushed in the cold, her eyes ringed red, but in her guardian mantle and ceremonial armor, she looks like a dragonborn lady out of our oldest legends. I kiss her hand. Antigone, who buries the dead. A private wake at the Sutter's house is held after the funeral. Annie and I make our way back to the city on foot. The dragons return without us to the caves. In the silence of our pilgrimage along the narrow footpath that circles the foothills of Pytho's keep back to the fir, I think on Atreus's words. "And we look to you, the guardians who remain, to continue their work. The work that I have, that is waiting for me, lies ahead. I don't know its shape, exactly, until I see Megara Roper among the mourners, waiting on the steps to the Sutter home.
Annie. When I accept Mrs. Sutter's invitation to the wake and see how Cor's face changes, I know. This will be my last visit to Duck's family. I joked that Cor should save his anger for after the funeral, but now I know it was not a joke. Cor hasn't forgotten, and may never forgive me for sending Duck out when he could have stayed behind. That's fine. I'll never forgive myself either. So for this last visit to their home, I do what I do best. I sit quietly, soaking up the warmth of a home, a family close, the things I've lost. I add to them the fresher ache of Duck's absence, like a hole in the heart of it all. Marina and Greg playing in their funerary black and being told off. Anna helping her mother prepare libation wine. Cor out back, with his father and the other guests starting the wake fire. I move through it all like a ghost, as if I'm already gone, and this world I walked in, borrowed from Duck, is already lost to me. Until on the back steps, I hear voices that I know. Cor's, with Megara Roper's. "We'll run it tomorrow," she says. "You like it?" Cor says,
"I think it sums it up."
"And Lee, tomorrow night?"
"He'll come."
I back into the kitchen and stumble headfirst into Lee.
"Hey, you seen Cor?"
I could confront him here, could ask him now, but I'm too dizzy with wine and sorrow and suspicions I hope aren't true to say the thing I should. So instead of asking him outright about what it means that Megara Roper wants to mate with him, I jab a thumb. "Out back." Lee notices something off in my face.
"Are you all right?"
Yeah. I'm heading out." His face fills with understanding.
"Of course," he says. "I'll find you later."
I stumble through the quiet streets of Highmarket alone, my mantle turned inside out, lest an angry citizen take opportunity at the sight of a guardian without her dragon. And that fear keeps at bay the thought that the last time I walked these streets, Duck was at my side. I breathe freely only when I'm back inside the palace gates. I have the girls' dorm to myself. Chrissa convalesces in the infirmary. Alexa has gone home with Deirdre for the night. And Orla's bed will never be filled again. I lie in mine and close my eyes. And when sleep doesn't come, I think of how Duck once led me to this bed when I was high with insomnia, tucked me in, and told me a bedtime story. Not caring that I couldn't love him as he loved me. Because he loved me more than that. Annie, you need to sleep. The tears come thick and fast. I press my palms against my wet eyes and strain to think of anything to escape this pain. And all that comes to mind is Griff. Soon, he'll be waiting on the driftless dunes for me. And somewhere along the way, twined with the words of Atreus's eulogy, my mind made up. I'll go to him. We recognize their sacrifice. We continue their work. This will be my work. I roll back out of bed, go to my desk, palming my face dry, and light a lamp. It takes a bit of rummaging in my desk to find it. The dragon tongue primer we used in our first years as guardians. The last time I looked at it, my handwriting was still a child's. It's like remembering an old friend. This girl who copied paradigms obsessively, who doodled tiny dragons in the margins during class, and wrote Antigone Sir Ayla out in dragon tongue to see how it looked. When my memories go to long evenings helping Duck with his homework, quizzing him on declensions while his face screwed up and his tongue stuck out, I let myself smile with the tears. He was always the one who convinced me we'd studied enough for the night. As I remember, I begin annotating with an adult hand for a different purpose. Lee comes in much later to find me working. He and I are alone. He smells of the wake fire and libation wine. His hair has snow in it. I had thought to do two things. Ask him about Megara and tell him about Griff. Instead, all I want is to hold and be held by him. How was it? He shakes his head in answer and takes my hand. I get to my feet and follow him to my bed. We crawl into it together, into each other's arms. I fit into them perfectly. Duck once did this. His voice is soft. I know. Somehow his knowing makes it all right. That and this. I snuff the lamp. Turn once to kiss him and taste the salt. Tomorrow. I'll tell him about Griff tomorrow. We fall asleep together. The next day, normal life resumes. Rations have been adjusted in the wake of the Passy's granary raid, but my appetite has been too little to feel the difference in a smaller helping of porridge. After breakfast, I make my way to Scholar's Row, numb steps tracing snow-shoveled streets through the heart of the city, an unmarked mantle covering my uniform. Winter has taken the city full force and filled it with a strange hush, except in the Lyceum courtyard, where students are building a snow dragon and laughing as they volley snowballs. Snowballs? They're my age, but I've never felt less like them. Inside, I follow the tide of students filing into the largest lecture hall. The only class I'm enrolled in besides Norish is History of the Revolution, a mandatory lecture that Lyceum students take in rotation. Lotus waves to me from beside an empty desk, but I ignore him. I sat with Duck for lectures. So now I'll sit alone. I'm making my way to an empty row when I catch sight of a handful of gold students huddled around a single desk, their heads bent. One of them looks up, sees me, and jumps away from the desk as if it shocked him. Another elbows the girl in the center, whose head shoots up. Annie? She says. It's Hannah Lund, my patrician friend from Dragon Tongue class. The one I got to know while accidentally ignoring Megara Roper last term. A piece of rag-like paper is suddenly folded in half, Hannah's hand atop it. But when she sees me looking, she stops short of shoving it out of sight. What's that? I ask. The professor hasn't arrived yet. I'm suddenly aware that I'm the only student in this class apart from Lotus, who is wearing a uniform. Glances are darting between me and Hannah like sparks. She inhales and, with a frozen expression, holds the piece of paper out to me. The Passy have covered our response to their granary raid. The headline reads, Defending the rich and oppressing the poor. Guardians do what dragon riders have always done. There are two poorly illustrated dragon riders firing on civilians underneath, in front of a crude rendition of the Lyceum, The dragon riders are labelled First Rider and Tertius of the Kallipolan Fleet. In other words, Power and I. For all the ways I've reflected on the night of the Lyceum raid with guilt and shame, my first thought is that this printing is a gross oversimplification that will provoke unrest in the city, and that it will be my job to manage, even as it undermines my legitimacy. It's going to make my job harder, and then make it harder for me to do my job. And it's a far cry from the coverage provided by the People's Paper and the Gold Gazette, which ran while we were in Fort Aaron, highlighting the toll the raid took on ration allotments and praising the guardians who defended the Lyceum as heroes. I look up to see Lotus joining the group with alarm on his face. My classmates are staring at us, and I realize Hannah has said something. We all know this is completely biased. We who? The Lyceans, who don't understand what it feels like to starve, who cannot fathom the kind of desperation that would drive class Ions to scale walls in search of grain? I hear myself answer her like someone else is saying it. You're not supposed to have this. It's illegal. Annie? Lotus murmurs, but it's like his voice is muffled. Hannah's eyes are bright, and for a fleeting instant, I think it's fear to be caught in possession of banned materials. But then the next thing she says doesn't fit. Are you all right? The last thing I need is a patrician's pity. I take Hannah's illegal leaflet, stuff it in my bag, and make my way to the nearest stretch of empty desks. And then I put my bag in the seat next to me, so no one will try to fill it. On the far side of the hall, Megara Roper has taken a seat next to Cor, her long hair spilling down her shoulders. The conversation overheard last night plays again in my head. We'll run it tomorrow. Cor looked at that picture of me firing on civilians and approved it while I stood in his home. And what am I to do now? I could report them, but even if I could convince myself Megara deserved it, does Cor? Whose sister goes hungry under this ration structure? Whose brother I just led to his death? Does anyone deserve to be reported for telling the truth? Especially by me, the one guilty of everything they accuse. My eyes are stinging, so badly that the chalkboard on which the professor is writing blurs. I blink them clear. Professor Lavinia has written a single word in block capitals. Drakthanasia. Shall we get started? I listen to her lecture about the poison that killed the dragons during the revolution with numb ears. Dragons are immune to most toxins, and the creation of Drakthanasia is a legendarily difficult art, she begins. And I stare at the back of Kor's head. At Megara Roper's thick mane, unable to stop seeing that cartoon, seething as the professor's words wash over me, hearing nothing. Why don't I remember Megara better from Dragon Tongue class? But I know the answer to that. I was so focused on Lee and Tyndale circling each other, so starstruck by the patrician students like Hannah Lund offering friendship, that I had eyes for no one else in that room. He'll come, Cor told Megara when she asked about Lee. Did Lee see this printing too last night? Did he approve it as well? Professor Lavinia says, Palace Day is the most famous day of the Red Month, but perhaps even more important to the success of the revolution was a night earlier in the Red Month known as the Widowing, when revolutionaries took Drakthanasia stolen from the Dragon Lord's own caches and used it to poison their fleet. It's like her words wake me up. Suddenly I'm listening, not just listening, alive. Alive with an excitement I'm not even sure it's decent to feel. Drachthenacia. Dragon poison. Revolution. It worked once, which means it could work again. Drachthenacia is painless, Lavinia goes on, designed to put dragons to sleep in old age, or out of their misery in cases of extreme pain. But the widowing itself is psychologically brutal for the rider. They suffer spells of sorrow sickness that lessen with time, but never entirely heal. This psychological blow to the Triarchy, though often overlooked, played a huge part in the final stages of the Red Month. It was also the final, most intimate betrayal, because it was the moment when the Dragonborn were betrayed by the servants they trusted most, their dragon's keepers. Dragon's keepers. Keepers like Griff. This is how we could do it. In the hour between revolutionary history and Norrish, I let myself into the Lyceum Library to find Lee sitting at one of the corner tables, the Passy's latest leaflet spread in front of him. But he's not looking at it. He's staring into space. I've spent the last 8 years taking comfort in the dusty smell of old books, the solace of forced quiet in libraries, when dorm life meant this was the only kind of privacy that could be found. That blank look on his face as he waits for the grief to pass. I know it. I take the seat beside him. That dark hair I ran my fingers through this morning. That face I cupped in the dawn light. Those lashes I studied as I reoriented myself from dreams where Duck was alive. I peel off my book bag and mantle and sit so our knees touch. There are students here and there around us, their work spread over tables, lamps glowing on their features. But the galleries of shelves stretching into the rafters have few windows, leaving the corner table in semi-darkness. He reaches gently across the distance to lay his hand on mine. And with the other, he folds the Passy's leaflet in half. Hiding the printing, I realize with a lump rising to my throat that he thinks to spare me. Of course he does. Because whatever disagreement there was the night of that raid, this is Lee. He has my back, and I can trust him. And now, most of all, I need that. So I push away my suspicions. It's all right, I've already seen it. Lee seems to work for words. Even for a whisper, they come out guttural. How was class? I shrug. It was about the widowing. The night they... Lee's lips form a line. I know what the widowing is. I noticed years ago that Lee avoids classes about the Red Month, but this is the first time I've ever heard him come close to admitting it. The first time I've considered this fact with a spike of curiosity. I don't know how to begin to find a Dragon Lord's cache of Drachthenacia, but Lee might. Asking him, on the other hand, that's hard to imagine. Lee's father's dragon wasn't killed in the widowing. She was kept alive for later, to be executed in a spectacle Lee and I witnessed. But I'm sure whatever memories he has of the Red Month include the widowing. It must have been horrible. Deirdre and Alexa are back, Lee murmurs, which means no more sharing beds. I nod, but don't remove my hand. The tips of his fingers trace my palm. It feels good enough to tighten my throat. Tell him. But maybe instead, I can start by showing him. Lee, are you free? Tonight? Lee's fingers rest on my palm.
Why?
There's someone I want you to meet. Lee avoids my eyes.
Can we do it another night? I've got plans.
Megara's question to Kor returns to me, and the date clicks into place for the first time. Is Lee coming tomorrow night? Plans indeed. I release his hand.
Did you know about it?
I ask. I can suddenly hear my own pulse in my ears. In the quiet of the library, it feels loud. Lee looks up, shoulders tensing.
What?
I point to the paper folded between us. Did you know about this? His eyes widen. He shakes his head. But he doesn't tell me I'm mistaken to wonder. And I don't know whether to be grateful he has the grace not to deny it, or to feel even more betrayed.
Seat taken?
Lee and I both jump. Megara Roper's hand is on the back of the seat with Lee's bag in it, and she's smiling at him. Though we're in the middle of the library, her voice is barely lowered. Nearby students have looked up from their work, startled by the sound.
Oh, says Lee, fingers curling over the passy's leaflet.
Megara reaches for Lee's bag and slides it to the floor. She takes the seat next to him, nods at the leaflet, and arches a brow at me.
Horrible what they print, isn't it?
Lee's shoulders draw up and hunch forward, as if hoping to interpose himself between me and Megara. But I don't want him to stand between us. I want him to tell her to go away. He doesn't. Doesn't look at me. I feel the absence of his touch on my palm, as if a cool draft had blown across it. I get to my feet.
Going somewhere?
Megara asks, with an air of disappointment. I nod, because my heart is racing at such a speed I feel too dizzy to speak. Lee finally looks at me, his face twisted.
Another night, he proposes, desperation in his voice.
Like he realizes that I'm sliding away from him and wants to catch me before I do. I stare back at him and imagine asking, another night, what? Another night, I take Lee to Griff Garrison, the boy who kept me from saving Duck, and ask him to share his memories of the Red Month. Another night, Lee explains to me why he wants to share a table with Megara Roper, who disappeared the night of the Lyceum raid just before Southside's daughter arrived. It felt good, waking up in his arms this morning. So good. Too good. A single student watches me from the other end of the library tables, his arms folded over his chest, his shaved head cocked to one side. The wings of the Fourth Order glint on the shoulder of his uniform in the smoky lamplight. With a surge of fury, I think, Lee can keep his secrets, and I'll keep mine. I hoist my bag onto my shoulder and cross the silent library to Power's table. He pulls the seat beside him out as I approach. I take it, swinging my book bag to the floor with a thunk that I don't bother to mask.
The city guard really needs to get a move on finding this rogue press,
Power says. Don't, I say, because the burning behind my eyes clogs anything more coherent.
You know who probably could tell them where to find it.
Stop. Power makes a noise of exasperation. A student nearby clears his throat, glaring at us as if to dare us to keep talking. Power twists in his chair and glares back. It's the first year from Norrish. He recognizes us, flushes, and hunkers back down over his book with shoulders around his ears. Power twitches back around and taps the book open before him with his index finger. It's his Norish primer.
So, do we go meet your new friend?
Lee. I woke this morning muggy with desire. For a blissful few moments, Annie was the only thing in the world. I hadn't killed Julia. The fleet hadn't come back without Duck. And I'd never stood in the cold outside Kor's house as his family tended Duck's snow-smoked wake fire and poured libation wine. There was only her. Auburn hair soft as down. A slender neck rippled with burn scars I knew by heart, freckles dusting pale cheeks that I kissed. Her eyes closed, her lips parting, her neck baring as she arched it back against the pillow. And I thought, let this moment, let this sight never end. I found the passy leaflet at breakfast. Last night, when I spoke with Megara briefly in the street outside Kor's home, all that she said was that the passy had something big planned for today. And even then, the half-thought floated in my mind that perhaps it was not too late to convince Annie to make the passy something we did together. Together, the way we lay tangled together this morning. Surely she would see the reason in it, the rightness. She told me once that New Pythos was the enemy, not Atreus, but surely together we could take on both. I didn't realize until I found that leaflet this morning what Megara meant by something big. She meant a cartoon depicting Annie firing on civilians. I looked down at that cartoon and agreed with all of it. We terrorized those we should have protected that night. We protected the rich and oppressed the poor as dragon riders have always done. Not we, she. But it felt like a fight from another life, from before Dark, from before the world shattered. And all I could think, looking down at an illustration of exactly the thing Annie had done the night of the Lyceum raid that had so horrified me at the time, was that I didn't want her to see it. That today's re-entry to normal life was going to be hard enough for her without this stupid piece of paper making it worse. Now I watch her cross the library to take a seat beside Power. Her red-brown hair, in a stub of a braid that I watched her pleat in bed this morning, bounces against the collar of her uniform as she slams down her bag. Power's gaze forgets me as it finds her, like his world has narrowed to a knife point. "Classist prig," Megara mutters, eyes on Power. "Should have let Jester finish him when he had the chance." I'd forgotten for a moment that she was here. The leaflet rests on the table between us. I unfold it. Megara waits, twirling a long black strand of hair in her fingers, her smile calculating, her bright eyes as green as her scarf. "So," she asks, "you coming tonight?" I look down at the illustration of dragon riders firing on cowering citizens. Annie, who should be better than this, defending Atreus and his ilk from starving men. Logs on a fire. Fires to burn the world down. A lifetime in the ashes of such a fire has taught me that it doesn't end there. Anyone can start a fire. The problem is what happens after. I refold the leaflet and hold it out to Megara. Then I get up, hoist my bag, and leave the library. As I knew she would, Megara follows. It's between bells. Outside, the corridor is deserted, classroom doors are closed, the stone walls bare except for bulletin boards advertising Lyceum student groups and posters of upcoming events. After I've closed the library door behind me, I round on her. My voice sounds loud, raised from a whisper. "Do the Passy have a positive vision of what they want, or is it just more of this?" I've had time to think on it since the night of the Lyceum raid, to wonder about the stolen grain, to ruminate on the fact that the Passy set a granary on fire that they weren't able to empty. The cartoon this morning only solidifies my caution. Guardians make good scapegoats, but scapegoats make poor solutions. The recklessness of fleeing with Southside's daughter on the night of the riot was heady, but I don't intend to tie myself to a ship without a rudder. Much less a ship making target practice out of my friends. Megara's smile flickers. She tucks the leaflet into her bag without looking at it. The wall is at her back. There's barely a foot between us. She's tall, but even so has to tilt her head back just a little to meet my eyes. Her glance flits down to the Guardian emblem on the breast of my uniform, before snapping back to my face. She says, "Of course we have a positive vision. We want equality. That's too vague. How would you put it? You want equal rights, which means constitutional reforms, abolition of the metals test, a reinstitution of the People's Assembly, protections for free speech." Megara smiles. "As they did in Deimos. As they did in Deimos." It's like we're putting words to the thing I've been wanting since I returned from Pytho's keep and Annie told me the truth. This is what I've been waiting for. This is what it's time to do. Get the power out of the hands of the bastard who took it from my family and into the hands of those who deserve it. "Well then," Megara says, green eyes dancing, "why don't you come tonight and say that?"
19. Nighttime Wanderings. Griff. The days after the Kallipolan airstrike pass in a haze. The feel of Sparker's key pressing into my palm at Delos' touch is like a dream, though the key is proof it wasn't. Memories of the moonlit meeting with the strange Kallipolan First Rider, the offer of another meeting in a few days' time. "She'll come," I tell myself. "She has to." I saw her waver. I know her heart. And she's smart enough to know a good offer when she sees it. The day I've planned to go and wait for Antigone, Ixion tells me I'll be serving at table for a council, an order I usually dread, and it's all I can do to keep from smiling. The council turns out to be between Ixion, Rhadamanthus, and his son Rhode, in apartments the Haorelians have co-opted in the Provisional Palace since the Great Lord's Hall burned. The chamber looks out over the sea, down on the sloping backs of Thorn Rose and Gnoll Karsts, the sigil of the Triarchy's three dragons circling the Black Clover of Exile mounts the wall. This part of the citadel survived the airstrikes well, though the windows buckled and stained in the heat. I'm preparing the steaming tea service at the side of the room when the door opens and a fourth guest arrives. Dilo. He stiffens at the sight of me. We haven't been in the same room, within speaking distance, since he brought back the little ones and gave me Sparker's key. "You're dead," Rhode says. Rhadamanthus gives his son a quelling look.
"Dilo, welcome. Come, sit."
Dilo advances, sits, and Rhadamanthus offers a tight smile to the other two.
"We have been informed that you are the one who let the peasants into the crypt with the dragonborn women and children. Is this true?"
Dilo's words come stiffly.
"It is, uncle."
Uncle is an elder honorific within the three families. There is no relation.
"But this would mean that you not only violated our airstrike protocol, but abandoned the battle to do so."
There is a pause that I study from the corner where I'm checking the steeped tea. Rhadamanthus has the tips of his fingers drawn together, over which he studies Dilo. I'm sure Dilo can read the Great Lord's warning as well as I can. This is his last chance to explain himself before his father is involved. Nestor will be even less pleased. Dilo clenches his fingers on the arms of his chair.
The Norsians in the Great Lord's Hall were locked in. This is clearly news to Rhadamanthus, and news to me that it's news to him. Dilo, seeing, rounds on Ixion and Rhod. I approach with tea. Rhod, Rhadamanthus says, did you modify my directions to provide Norsian families with shelter? I pour tea into Rhadamanthus's cup first, Ixion second, Rhod's third. My arm is steady. Rhod says, after a fraction of a hesitation,
a little, father, yes.
Dilo makes a noise of disgust. As I fill his cup, his eyes flick upward, lightning fast, to mine, then return to the conversation. I feel a pulse begin in my ears that has nothing to do with the subject they're discussing. The last time we were so close, I was on my knees before him, and his trembling fingers touched my chin.
Please explain your reasoning.
A slight edge in Rhadamanthus's voice makes Rhod and Ixion sit straighter. Ixion has paled even by the standards of his own pasty house. He looks at Rhod, then answers for him.
It was only the logical conclusion of your plan, he says. You wanted to disabuse the peasants of their infatuation with the Kallipolan First Rider. I thought that lesson would be better driven home if they were not allowed to skip class, especially for the humble riders who might be considering fairer pastures.
For all my effort to control my hands, the teapot lands on the tray with a clank.
And it was an effective lesson, was it not?
I realize Rhod is speaking to me. The eyes of the other three rise to mine. Ixion's are sparkling with subdued mirth. We haven't spoken of my family since that day. Ixion hasn't asked if the little one survived, hasn't referenced any interference on the part of Dilo. And from that, I can only assume that he didn't care enough about the outcome to concern himself with it. But the joke's on him, because I've found fairer pastures after all.
Aye, my lord. We're all the fonder of our lords after they locked our children in burning buildings.
Dilo snorts into his tea. Ixion scowls, but Rhadamanthus lifts a hand, nodding at me.
Griff makes the valid point. It's a delicate balance between too little fear and too much. You must tread carefully.
Rhod looks as though he is struggling not to roll his eyes.
Has she replied to your latest?
Rhadamanthus asks Ixion.
She. Freyda?
No, but she will, especially when she hears news of what the Kallipolans did to her ships.
I return with tea biscuits.
Thank you, Griff, Rhadamanthus says, and then he adds with a half glance up at me. That was some spectacular flying during the attack. If only the rest of the fleet fought so bravely.
Dilo sets down his cup.
Many of them could have fought more bravely if their dragons had been free to fire.
His voice is shaking. I stop dead, staring at him instead of returning the biscuits to the tea service. Ixion, Rhod, and Rhadamanthus glance, one by one, at me.
We've been over the reasoning for this before, Rhadamanthus tells Dilo.
Dilo's fingers are curling on his knees.
The reasoning's absurd. We lost half the citadel because a third of our fleet was muzzled.
Rhadamanthus clears his throat and looks at me.
Griff, please excuse us.
I let myself out of the room with my heart racing. As soon as I close the door after myself, I hear the voices resume, raised on the opposite side of it. It's the first time I realized the decision to muzzle wasn't unanimous, and that Dilo opposed it.
Is Papa in there?
I look down. In the shadow of the corridor, I didn't even notice the child crouching by the door holding a doll.
My little lordling Astyanax. Where's your nurse?
Don't like her, Astyanax says. He holds up his doll. It's a dragon sewn from black fabric, wings flapping loose.
His name is Sparker.
Astyanax points to the snout.
He doesn't like it.
As much as I've always liked Astyanax, this takes me by surprise. I bend to look closer. The stuffed animal dragon has a little twine muzzle wrapped round his jaw. I feel a flutter in my chest like a caged bird.
No, he doesn't.
A figure appears at the end of the corridor and lets out an exclamation in Norrish.
Thank the shrines! I wasn't sure where he went.
It's Shay, my sister's friend from Clan Thornrose, the one I never danced with.
You're Astyanax's nurse?
I ask in surprise. She takes Astyanax's hand, recognizes me, and fumbles to straighten her hair scarf with her free hand.
I am now. The attack. She was older. Her lungs didn't take to the smoke.
Astyanax is testing dead weight on Shay's arm, oblivious to our Norrish.
Can we go see the real Sparker sometime, Shay? He asks in dragon tongue.
I crouch in front of Astyanax and answer in his language. Shay will bring you, but only if you listen well to her. She's my friend. Astyanax gasps with full delight. Shay mouths, thank you, over his head, and I head out of the citadel with a spring in my step. I've got Sparker's key waiting deep in a sack of grain. Becca and Garrett home safe and sound. A secret trip to Kallipolis all on my own tonight. And Rhadamanthus's youngest son is naming his doll after Sparker. Not Ryla, not Nita, but Sparker. My beautiful, wild, too big Sparker. Whose muzzle Astyanax's doll doesn't like, and neither, it turns out, does Dilo. When I return home in the evening, the strangest end to this day is that Grandad's out in the alleyway, touching up the signs of our clan cast on the lintel. It's been a long time since I've seen him concern himself with more than his chair by the fire.
Griff, hold this, will you?
He hands me a pot of woad, which he must have borrowed from a neighbour, because ours dried out years ago. I'm terrible at maintaining the clan signs.
Granda, stop, I'll take care of it.
The fresh air's good for me.
Grandad's just looking at the doorframe, like he's going to stare at it hard enough to take the warp out of it.
The boy's got new shoes,
he tells me, as he traces each sign. Thumb and forefinger pinching together, then drawing apart to form the nag's bent head.
Yeah. And your sister's got herbs for her lungs.
Yeah, they're from Dilo, Lord Dilo.
Good of him.
I nod. Granda finishes the last sign. He straightens, but instead of leading the way back inside, he turns to me. It's been so long since I've looked him eye to eye when he has a clear gaze that I'd forgotten what it feels like.
When your da gets back, he says, I want you to answer for this household without shame.
I feel a cold trickle into my gut. Da's been gone for years. His charter never recovered. There was not an exact day where Aga and I went from hoping to mourning, but it wasn't a turn I came back from. But it's always draining to talk about it with Granda, who's still waiting.
Granda, he's not.
Granda lifts a hand.
We're not talking about Garrus. We're talking about Garrus' son. You've had to shoulder more than your share since he's been gone. But that doesn't mean you should be doing things for this family that don't sit right.
I stare at him. To my surprise, his voice is rough with emotion. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about things these dragon lords might be asking of you that you don't want to give.
Slowly, like cold water seeping through the toes of my boots, I realize what he's talking about. And even though I feel sick enough that I suddenly think I might vomit before my own granda,
It comes with a feeling that something has finally been ripped open and shown to the light. I don't anymore. I hear myself say it. That one word, anymore. Lord Dilo? Granda asks. I feel lightheaded as I shake my head. He's never asked anything of me. I'm glad it's getting dark. Glad he can't really see my face, nor I his. Good, he says. He places his hand on my shoulder, grips it and releases. I hope I live to see the day when Garrus returns to find a son grown. This time I let the knife twist without arguing it. He turns and leads the way inside. We don't talk about it again for the rest of the evening, but the conversation doesn't stop turning in my head, circling like a puzzle I'm trying to solve. Until finally, after we've put out the lamp and the back room is dark, as the family falls asleep around me, I understand. When I get up and head for the Citadel to make my meeting with Antigone, I take a single detour on the way to Sparca. I know where Delos chambers are, though I haven't visited them in years. Not since we were kids, and we got in trouble for his inviting me. I was beaten, he wasn't. We didn't try it again. The hall is mostly dark, the nearest lit sconce around the corner. I knock as softly as I can and pray it's loud enough. For a moment, as I wait in the silence, the insanity of it tempts me to turn tail and walk away. But then he opens the door. Griff? He sounds half asleep and more than half confused. His curling hair is flattened to one side of his head, his tunic unbuttoned at the collar. I step over the threshold, and then, because Dilo seems too startled to move, I close the door myself. His chamber, the size of several homes from Clan Nag added together, is lit by a single candle by the bed, the shadows long on the high ceiling and floor-length drapes. You never asked anything of me. You give what you don't expect in return. That's the realization that came from my conversation with Granda. Though can it really be called that, when words are put on the thing you've known all along, and suddenly you know why it matters? What? No, of course not. You're not like Julia. For the first time in my life, I've used Dragon Tongue's informal you. Dilo's eyes focus on my face. And all at once, he seems wide awake. I try not to be. We've turned, as I close the door, so that now he stands against it and I face him. We stand as close as we stood the last feast day, when I leaned toward him and he jerked closer. And his breathing has gone light again, telltale light, and I'm alive as if I'm riding Sparker. Griff, I never wanted it to be like that. His eyes are so close as Julia's used to be, except his are so dark they're almost black. It wouldn't, I tell him. Our voices are soft, barely a whisper, as I lift my fingers to trace the back of his neck, to snag the curls at the nape. Why wouldn't it? He asks. Because I want it. Dilo swallows, a beautiful, shuddering swallow, and I catch his mouth on mine. When I leave, I don't tell him where I'm going. By midnight, I'm flying with Sparker over the lowland marshes of the northern shore of Kallipolis, familiar from the maps Nestor's shown us when he rants about the long-awaited return. The driftless dunes, an uninhabited stretch halfway between Fort Arran and Basil's Cape, is a barren mix of dead seagrass and swelling dunes,
And tonight it's a sea of darkness, except for the single fire lit in a valley between two dunes a few hundred yards from the shore. Easy to spot from the air, next to impossible to spot from the ground. Antigone is there, waiting with her dragon and that other Storm Scourge rider, the one from last time. "Knew you'd come," I tell her. In the light of her driftwood fire, the corner of her mouth turns up. The other dragon rider steps forward. "My name's Power," he says, "and this is Eater. We'll be doing patrols overhead while you two have surf school, or whatever this is supposed to be." "Thanks, Power," says Antigone. "You can go now." But Power seems to be puffing himself up for a good long threat. "Any funny business," he tells me, "and I will make you wish your lords." Antigone snaps at him in Kalish, and he rolls his eyes. Once Power, Sir Eater, has gone, Annie turns back to me. Her little Aurelian is curled close to the fire, red in the light of the flames, and she spread a woolen blanket over the sand next to her. "Are you hungry?" "Oh yeah, always." She opens a satchel, pulls out books and bread, and settles on one side of the blanket. I tear into the bread with enthusiasm, and only notice after about half of it's gone that Antigone has been watching me, not partaking herself. I swallow. "Thought you all had a food shortage." A line appears between her eyebrows, accentuated in the warm glow of the fire. It occurs to me that I probably shouldn't be bringing up a food shortage caused by our airstrikes on their trade fleet. "It doesn't apply to people like me," she says. "Lucky you." Antigone rubs her thumb between her brows. "I've brought a dragon tongue primer," she says, rapping knuckles on one of the books spread on the blanket between us. "But before that, I want to ask you a few questions." A few questions turns out to be an interrogation. Antigone opens a notepad and questions me about New Pythos for an hour. Numbers, names, family trees, maps she makes me label. And at the end, she asks some of the questions a second time. I think at first it's because she failed to note my answers on the first go, but then I realize she's double-checking me for inconsistencies, making sure I didn't fabricate. Thorough, this one. "One more thing," I tell her. "Ixion's been making overtures to Freyda, the Basilean princess. That was why she had those ships in port, the ones that you burned." Antigone cocks her head. "Freyda, daughter of the God King. What does he want with her?" "She's of age to marry. I think he's hopeful that those burned ships might incentivize her to take a side." Antigone exhales slowly, and a wisp of hair puffs away from her face. "Well," she says grimly, "she'd be justified, as some of us argued at the time." With a twitch of her shoulder, she reaches for the primer, opens it, and turns it so I can see the first page. She slides her lantern across the blanket to flood it with light. "This is the dragon tongue alphabet," she says. As we work, our dragons settle closer to us, and Sparker nudges his head against my side. Antigone's focus is unwavering and unsmiling, except for the one time she looks up and notices my spare hand absently working over Sparker's jaw, up under the muzzle where it's always a little sore. "Is it locked on?" "Welded." "How long has he had it?" "Since he sparked. They did all of us when he sparked."
"He sparked first?"
A little note of something I can't identify vibrates in Antigone's voice. "Yeah, but it was bad timing. We'd sort of attacked someone. Someone dragonborn." Antigone is staring at us, her brows contorted like she isn't sure whether to laugh or look horrified. I take a breath and admit my most terrible crime. "We sort of attacked Ixion, Sir Neater."
It was, and remains, one of the sweetest moments of my life, or Sparker's. And even knowing how it ended, a muzzle for every humble dragon, I still have a hard time thinking I wouldn't do it all over again if I had the chance. Ixion bawled like a child. I couldn't stop laughing, even during the punishment afterward.
Oh, says Antigone.
Had to live up to his name, didn't he? I joke, patting Sparker's flank. Antigone's lips part in surprise, a smile spreading that she doesn't explain. I gave Sparker his name in jest. By the time they realized I had, he was already so used to it he wouldn't respond to anything else. But when he sparked, and his flames blanketed Ixion Sir Neter until Dilo and Julia pulled us off, it only made our sentence worse. I was sure they were going to drop me after my time in the pen was up. When they gave the humble dragons the muzzle instead, I almost wished they had. After an hour, when Power Sir Eater returns, my head's hurting from our study. Antigone presses the primer into my hands, along with an empty notepad and a pen for me to practice with, and we agree on another meeting in 3 nights' time. She's strapping her satchel to her dragon, and I'm smothering the fire when I finally get the courage to ask her. So how do we do it? How do we bring them down? Antigone pauses, removing her boot from the damp fire. I've been thinking about that. The squires, you're in charge of dragon keeping, aren't you? And that includes feeding. I nod. Antigone snaps her satchel shut. Then we should do it the way the revolutionaries did in Callipolis. Poison their half of the fleet. It seems too simple to be believed, and I should be thrilled at how simple it is. Instead, I feel a little sick. Bung deal for the dragons. I sound so soft, pointing that out. But I tend these animals daily. Cart their feed and dung and scrub them down. You can't help having a healthy respect for the beasts you count that many hours with. Antigone nods. She seems to have thought about this too. I know. It would be awful. For their riders too. In our revolution, it was called the widowing. I shiver at the